listening to The Worried Writer, helping you to overcome fear, self-doubt, and procrastination to get the work done. I'm your host, Sarah Painter, and I'm a novelist and self-confessed worried writer. For show notes, resources, and much more, please head to worriedwriter.com. And now, on with the show. Hello, and welcome to episode 2 of The Worried Writer. First off, I just want to make a quick apology if I'm a wee bit breathy today. I seem to have a touch of hay fever. My guest today is Stephanie Burgess, author of fantasy fiction for children, teens and adults. As well as being a frighteningly productive and award-winning writer, Stephanie is a supportive and generous person. I loved having an excuse to chat with her, and she shares so many insights into her routine and process that I'm certain you'll find something useful. We talk about the importance of both discipline and being kind to ourselves, which can often feel like two warring sides of my personal creative psyche. Before we get to the interview, I thought I'd share a little bit about what I've been doing this week. Or, more honestly, what I haven't been doing this week. Namely, writing. I'm recording this on the 23rd of April, and apart from blog posts and this podcast, I haven't been getting a huge amount of work done. I finished a messy first draft of a new book at the beginning of the month, and I took some time off while my kids were on their Easter holiday, and I'm finding it really hard to get back into writing. I don't know if any of you can relate to this, but it terrifies me. One of the reasons I try to write regularly is that this always happens when I take a break. I instantly feel like a fraud, or even more of a fraud than usual. I worry that I'm not professional enough to build the career that I want, that I'm not a real writer. A technique that I use when being overly harsh with myself or when I feel very anxious about something is to try to speak to myself as if I was someone else. Okay, that probably doesn't make any sense. What I mean is this. I pretend that whatever problem I'm facing or thoughts I'm having are actually being experienced by a friend, and my job is to give advice to that friend. I am immediately kind and loving and sometimes very helpful. It's uncanny. So, to this friend who is experiencing this current panic over not writing, I would say this. It's going to be okay. You just finished a draft and your brain needs time to relax. Your creative energy needs to be rejuvenated. This has happened many times before and the writing always comes back. Perhaps you already use this technique of giving advice to another, but if not, I'd definitely recommend it. In other news, the show has had a wonderful response so far and I'm hugely grateful. I've had lots of lovely feedback on episode 1, which I appreciate so much. I wanted to give a quick shout out to Susan Mann, who's at Susan K. Mann, M-A-N-N, on Twitter, and Andy Robb, at That Andy Bloke, for their kind and supportive comments. I truly appreciate it. I've also had my first writing-related question. A huge thank you to Ever-Growing Brain on Twitter for asking this great question. He wrote, I do wonder if forcing words out ever becomes good stuff, and if you keep tabs on which bit you write under duress and which bits were easy. Are 500 rubbish words still better than no words at all? Or do they not count if they aren't good? Now, I'm sure we can all relate to that question. There are many days when getting the words done feels like pulling teeth, and it seems logical that these words, dragged unwillingly to fill that day's quota, will be less good than those which flowed more easily during an inspired writing session. My experience, for what it's worth, is that by the time I finish the draft and let it rest and then gone back to read it, I honestly can't tell which words came easily and which did not. I slogged my way through 50,000 words of a book once before deciding that life was too short to spend this amount of effort on something I hated. I put the book in the metaphorical bottom drawer. A year later, I read it with surprise and pleasure. There was actually lots of good stuff in there. So, to answer your question, I don't think the quality of the words matter for two reasons. Firstly, because you're too close to assess quality at the time. You need to finish the project and let it rest before you know. Secondly, I'm a great believer in practice and focusing on the practice or process of writing rather than the end result. Even if you feel that you're slogging through your words and you're just going to end up deleting them all anyway, Just keep going and count them all towards your day's quota. Yes, you might delete them, but it's sometimes necessary to write the wrong words before you get to the right ones, and you should still get the credit. The only thing I would add to that is if you're finding every single writing session a horrible slog, then it might be worth considering whether there is something wrong with the big picture. It might be that you're trying to write a book for the wrong reasons, or perhaps your subconscious is trying to tell you that there is a major issue with your plot or character motivation, and that's something that you might want to stop and think about. I do hope that answers your question. Thank you again for writing in. If you guys have any further suggestions or experiences to share, do get in touch. And if you'd like your question answered on the show, please email me at sarah@worriedwriter.com or find me on Twitter at @SarahRPainter or use #WorriedWriter. Finally, if you can spare the time to leave me a review on iTunes, that would be brilliant. Reviews are really important to the success of the show. Plus, while you're there, you can hit subscribe and make sure you never miss an episode. Thank you for listening, and now on with the interview. Welcome to the interview section of the podcast. My guest today is Stephanie Burgess, author of short stories and novels that mix the genres of fantasy and historical. Stephanie has published many short stories in both magazines and anthologies, one of which, Dancing in the Dark, made me sob, and the Cat Incorrigible trilogy. The Cat books are children's fiction or middle grade, and they mix Regency England with fantasy. The first book, An Improper Magic, came out in 2010. It won the Waverton Goodread Children's Award for Best Debut Novel and was longlisted for the British Fantasy Award and the Bramford Bowes Award for Best Debut Children's Novel. I've known Stephanie online for a couple of years now, and I'm continually impressed by her productivity. No matter what is going on in her life, she seems to pull amazing word counts out of the bag with an astonishing regularity. I'm delighted to have her on the show for completely selfish reasons. I'm hoping to glean the secret to her amazing work ethic and productivity. Welcome to the podcast, Stephanie, and thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
You're very welcome. Well, I hope I covered a little bit of your background in the introduction, but just to break the ice with the audience, could you tell us a little bit more about your work?
Sure. So I write fantasy in various categories, children's and adults, and a bit of teen as well. My first three novels were, as you said, they're in the 9 to 12 category. In the UK, they actually have a different title from the US, which is confusing. In the UK, the series is called The Unladylike Adventures of Cat Stevenson. So they're sort of magical romps set in Jane Austen's England. And then I've got a fourth book coming out, which is actually in adult fiction section, adult science fiction fantasy, but it's a historical fantasy set in an 18th century palace in Hungary, and that's really fun too.
That sounds wonderful. So, yeah. And you were saying there's different titles. I was having a look, and the very first book in the Cat series is a most improper magic, and then it's a Tangle of Magics.
And a reckless magic.
And in the US?
It's Cat Incorrigible, uh-huh. Renegade Magic, and Stolen Magic.
They're all great titles.
Thank you.
three great titles weren't enough. You've got six.
Well, it actually went through even more than that, because when I first wrote the first book, I had three titles set up for it, and they were completely different. None of my publishers wanted them for good reason.
That's so often the way, isn't it? That's one of the things I've learned about being the other side.
I've gotten very laid back about which titles end up on my books.
Absolutely. I know I was talking to my agent about a working title for my latest, and I couldn't really get all that bothered, because I thought, if it does get taken on, I know they're not going to use it. So
yes, exactly. That's exactly how it feels.
And just call it new book.
Absolutely.
But it's definitely one of the things to get used to. So if it's okay with you, I'd like to move on to your routines and processes. I mean, I've always been obsessed with these things. So I was wondering if you could talk me through a typical writing day, if there is such a thing.
Sure. Well, I have two young children. My six-year-old is in full-time school, so he's easy nowadays in terms of my writing routine. My younger son, though, is 20 months old, and he only has childcare for two mornings a week. So that means my writing routine has to be very careful and very much oriented around his schedule. I'm lucky because my husband is also a writer and a web designer and actually also an ebook cover designer. He does many things, but they're all freelance. And so we're both at home all day, which means we can juggle the childcare. Uh-huh. And we've got a very, very careful routine set up where for a certain number of hours each day, you know, I have our younger son, and for a certain number of hours he has him, and so on. And the way it works out is that on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays, I have free time from 12:30 until 3:20, which is when my husband gets back from picking up my older son from school, and I get both boys until bedtime. And then on Wednesdays and Fridays, which is when my younger son goes to childminder for the morning, it's bliss because I get 3.5 hours in the morning and 2 hours later in the afternoon. It's incredible. Uh-huh. So we've just started doing that in the last month, and you know, that's a whole new world.
Having that block of time.
Yes. Mm. Oh, it makes such a difference.
Absolutely. I completely empathize. I used to write when my youngest was at nursery for 2 hours in the morning. And I did used to get an awful lot done in that time. But now that they're both at school.
Oh, I can only imagine. We were counting down. I mean, we were literally counting down the years and the months until my older son was going to be in full-time school and we were going to have all this writing time. And of course, I got pregnant about 9 months before he started full-time school, so we never experienced that.
But it will come. And when it does, it is awesome.
Oh.
Oh, that's wonderful. And so do you find that it's conducive to your productivity having that? I'm going to look for a silver lining with the having the clearly bounded I've only got X amount of time. Do you find that
Absolutely.
Helps?
Mm. It makes me very motivated. Mm. I mean, I have to get the work done. I can't sit there procrastinating or surfing the web or doing any of the many things I used to do in the old days, the old child-free days on my you know, days at home. I know if I want to get it done, I have to get started, and I have deadlines and I have a career I'd like to progress and so on. So, and that's actually enough most days to push me past the initial kind of inertia and reluctance that I think you always feel, just like people feel before they go jogging. You know, even if you know you'll love it when you're out there, you don't want to start.
No.
So having a very strict timetable and only a limited amount of time makes me very, very eager to begin my writing.
So that's your secret. Be very, very busy. Have two small children. Very limited time. Okay.
And yeah, well, I have to say, actually, back years ago when I had a full-time job and I used to write during my lunch hour, I was very frustrated at my lack of writing time. I felt I really wanted to be getting more writing time. I was very jealous of my friends who were full-time writers, et cetera. But actually, every lunchtime, I would sit down and I would write 1,000 words.
Wow.
Well, then I ended up giving up the full-time job. And you know, the surprising thing is, my top productivity in a day my entire life has been about 1,000 words.
Oh, I love that you just said that. I was going to ask you about word count, and I tend to, a good session for me is 1,000 words. And
exactly.
I keep wanting to be faster, essentially. Mm-hmm. And again, I used to write 1,000 words when my son was at nursery. Mm-hmm. Now he's at school until 3:05.
Yep.
1,000 words is a good time.
It's a really good day.
That makes me feel so much better.
Yeah, it made me realize that when you're very motivated and you're working super efficiently, you can get the same amount done in a lunch hour.
Right, okay.
And so I have to say, well, there are many things that are great about being a full-time writer. And I think I think it's very useful for doing the social media aspect. It's very useful for all the stuff that surrounds being an author.
Yes.
But as a writer, my productivity wasn't any different when I was a full-time, you know, worker somewhere else.
Well, apart from that being just wonderful to hear on a personal level, I think that's also hugely encouraging for anybody listening who is at a different stage of the journey to know that the actual writing, the really important bit, can be fitted in.
It really can. I mean, I don't want to make an unfair generalization because people have their own situations, and
Absolutely.
I'm never going to be one of those people who says, if you're a writer, you will write no matter what, because sometimes you can't.
No,
you know,
absolutely.
People go through terrible situations. People are overwhelmed. I know one of my favorite authors, actually, of paranormal romance, Thea Harrison. I love her books, and I was just introduced to them from her first book as Thea Harrison a few years ago. And so I went and I looked her up, and it turned out that actually this is a new pen name for her. She had started publishing originally when she was 18, I think. And it was with Harlequin Books. It was under a different name. She published a whole bunch, and then she went through personal life changes. And I don't know her personally. This is just what I've gotten from her website. So I don't want to be inaccurate. But I believe what happened was something like after a divorce, she had to go back to college and get a new job and be a single parent. That is my understanding. And she didn't write for something like 20 years. Well, none of that stopped her being a writer because then, and 20 years later, the kids were adult. She started writing again, and I have to say, I love her new books. I haven't clicked with her earlier books, and it was a good reminder to me that all those silly statements you'll see people making about, oh, real writers always write, real writers don't let anything stop, whatever. Those are completely false. Yes, and I mean, that being said, I've had to work very hard to make the writing time. I had to work very hard to get that writing time when I was. In my last day job, I had to make the decision whether I was going to finish my PhD because my funding had run out after 3 years of PhD work, and I had to get a full-time job. And I realized I just could not. At the beginning, I thought, well, I'll finish my thesis this year, and I'll keep writing. I'll write during my lunch sessions, and then when I get home from work, I'll do my PhD
But
thesis.
of
And I
course.
thought, oh, where's the problem with that? And that lasted 3 days. So I had to make a decision, and I chose the writing. And that was a difficult decision. That was a life decision. And then since my kids have been born, it's been very difficult trying, forcing that time and energy into the writing again. So it does take work. It takes a lot of effort and commitment, but
Absolutely. And also there's a sort of scheduling timing issue, but I think as you were just alluding to, there's also life stuff can blindside us.
absolutely.
And I mean, sometimes people say things like, there's no such thing as a creative block. Oh, plumbers don't get plumbing block. They just go and do their job, and it's the same for writers. And to an extent, I understand where that sentiment's coming from. It's saying it's a craft, you get on with it, get your backside in the chair, go for it. And to an extent, I can see the value in that. But we're not digging a ditch. It
Now.
is in It is a mental sort of energy that you
It is
require, and
mental and
sometimes
emotional.
an emo exactly. And if there are other things going on in your life, sometimes that will stop you. And I think that it's very dangerous to suggest to people that they're somehow less of a writer or not a writer or any of those very damaging statements. I completely agree with you.
Absolutely. Yes, I know. I have one friend who's a writer who her father passed away last year, and I read a really interesting thing she'd written about. She forced herself. She was not going to miss her deadline. She was a professional writer. She was going to finish her book. And she's never had to do so many rewrites on a book. And honestly, looking back, she said possibly it would have been just as productive in the long run to give herself time to grieve in between.
It's very difficult, the professional writer stick that we do sometimes use to beat ourselves with, because I think I'm speaking for everybody now, of course, but I feel very, very lucky to get to do this. So because I feel so
Absolutely.
lucky, I then feel that I ought to be super professional and super productive. And so to get, anyway, I could just waffle on this forever, but I really wanted to get back to your productivity because I was researching you again in a non-scary way. And I wasn't at all surprised to hear about your academic background. And also before that, I believe music.
Yes, I was a musician, but I trained originally at a music conservatory as a French horn performance major.
That's fascinating. And I know what little I know about musicians is that they work so hard, and daily practice is just a given. There's no ifs or buts about it. And I wondered whether being a musician to that level and being an academic to also a very high level, whether those things sort of translated into this work ethic that you have for writing.
Yes, I think it's definitely helped my training as a musician. I mean, ever since. All right, I think my voice is back.
That's okay.
Yes.
Take your time.
So I started playing the piano when I was six, and I played some other instruments in between. And then when I was 10, I started playing the French horn, which became my instrument, and as well as playing the piano through for 12 years. Anyway, but with the French horn, you know, I had to practice every single day, and it started out as 15 minutes a day. By the time I was at university, it was 3 hours a day plus my hours of rehearsals. And that often meant staying up until midnight or 1 a.m. to get it done, get the practicing in. And I was so often not in the mood. There were so many things I would have preferred. I loved the French horn. I didn't love the practicing. Mm-hmm. And no one loves the practicing. Having to do all the technical training, it's really boring. Mm-hmm. It's really tedious. You play the same things again and again and again and again and again. Uh-huh. And learning to do that gave me incredible discipline. And I've been very grateful to that. I haven't played the French horn since I graduated from music conservatory, because I decided I wasn't going to be a professional musician. I didn't want that life. I decided I was going to shift over into the academic side of music and do music history.
Okay.
And that was the right decision, but it was also a very painful decision to make, because I had put so many years into training to be professional, and I couldn't stand to listen to myself being unprofessional by playing at an amateur level, because if I wasn't going to practice 3 hours a day, I couldn't sound as good. And that was a sad thing. But I'm always going to be grateful that I did do that much practicing and that I did train as a musician, because it taught me how to be self-disciplined and force myself to do the work even when I was too tired and even when it was the last thing I felt like doing.
Absolutely. What prompted the move? So you moved from professional musician to academic musician. How did the change from academic to fiction author go? How did that happen?
Well, I'd always been writing. I knew from the time I was seven, I wanted to be a writer. And that was my big dream. this probably says a lot about my practicality, but I thought of the music as my day job. So yeah, that says a lot.
That's classic.
Yes, but the writing was my biggest dream, you know, always from the time I was seven. I was always writing little short stories. I did a little magazine for my family. You know, I formed a writer's club with my brothers, who are both writers now. Also.
Oh, wonderful.
But so that was always going on in the background, but I didn't talk about it. You know, I majored in music and I was going to have my musical day job. But the writing was something that I kept very private and that I felt very vulnerable. And I thought of it as a very unrealistic fantasy, even as I kept writing. I thought it was so unrealistic that I would ever actually get published, because I didn't know any real authors in my life. Well, what happened, it was sort of a two-part process. And the first part was when I was 19, I got a job at my first university as the assistant to the director of the Clarion East Science Fiction and Writing Workshop.
Okay.
And that's a very, well, it's, I'm trying to think of how old it is now, 3 or 4 decades old. Mm-hmm. It's an old program in America. It's a residential workshop, a 6-week workshop. Writers have to compete by auditioning to get in.
Gosh.
There's usually 16 or 17 writers who get in every year. And so you're there for 6 weeks. You write one short story a week. And every week there's a new author in residence. And so every week you read and critique all of your classmates' stories around the table, and also the author in residence critiques your story, and you have a little one-on-one meeting with them to discuss your writing. So I was the assistant to the director to that when I was 19, and that was amazing. I wasn't there for the actual critiquing or anything, but it made me start thinking about how much I wanted to do that one day.
Uh-huh.
And so then, 5 years later, I ended up finally applying. And I applied not to Clarion East, which is where I'd worked, but to Clarion West in Seattle, because it would have felt too strange to apply. It would have been too odd to actually know the people, especially because that was in my hometown. It's a residential program. I didn't want to stay at my parents' house and to do it. I wanted to be real part of the program. So I applied to Clarion West in Seattle, and I got in, which was fantastic. And so at that point, I was in the middle of my master's degree in Pittsburgh, University of Pittsburgh. And but I flew out to Seattle for those 6 weeks. And that was me publicly saying for the first time in my life, I'm a writer. And I'd actually even published a couple short stories before that, but I always thought, well, those were kind of a fluke. Don't talk about them, you know? So I got there and people were asking about my writing and I felt like this total imposter. I was like, oh, you guys are real writers. I'm just someone who wants to be a writer, you know? But that was the beginning. By the end of the 6 weeks, I was talking about myself very confidently as a writer. I had learned so much. My writing had gotten so much better. And I had this whole community suddenly. Mm-hmm. We had, even after we left, we still kept this class listserv where we were all emailing back and forth. We sent each other our stories. And quite importantly, I'd also met Patrick, who's now my husband. So he's English. He was living in Bristol at that point. Uh-huh. But we made a deal that he would move anywhere in the UK where I got a fellowship for my postgrad.
Oh, wonderful.
So I finished up my master's as quickly as possible. And I got a fellowship at the University of Leeds for my PhD.
Okay.
And I moved out there and Patrick moved with me. And so from then on, we had a built-in writer's group of each other. We were each other's partners.
Well, that's wonderful. That's handy.
It really
it's
is.
It's very efficient of you.
Extremely efficient. I actually Good job. My PhD partner. And from there, it was sort of a matter of, you know, gradually, many years, actually. I think, it wasn't until 2004 that I published my first story in a professional level mm-hmm. magazine. Mm-hmm. And then I didn't sell my first novel until 2008. Mm-hmm. So that was 2008, 7 years after the Clarion Workshop. I was 31 when I sold my first trilogy. Mm-hmm. But it all started with going to that writer's workshop.
Uh-huh. And as you say, sort of really coming out as...
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And also, as you say, meeting other people and realizing that everybody feels a bit like an imposter. And
yes.
maybe actually this is something that like normal human beings can do.
Yes. I mean, that
Very
sounds...
Very exciting.
It sounds silly, but it was a shock to me because I grew up and I didn't think of writers as real people. You know, and it's why I didn't think of it as realistic that I could mm-hmm. be one, no matter how much I wrote and no matter how much I loved writing, mm-hmm. because I was a normal, ordinary person.
Mm-hmm. I could not agree with you more. I had exactly the same feeling. I thought that writers lived in a black and white picture of a library, yes. were often male, and holding a little tumbler glass of whiskey. So
right.
I thought
Whereas
I was on a hiding
I probably,
to nothing.
I don't know if I had a really strong image, but I think at least my image of a writer was probably female because most of my favorite writers were women, mm-hmm. but someone very, very cool.
Oh, absolutely.
Very, very sophisticated.
Mm. Yes, that imposter syndrome is, it doesn't really go away. I don't know what you think. Do you think
it
just goes?
No. Mm-hmm. I know. Every time I sell a new story, I think, oh, thank God.
So you started with short stories, which is so impressive. Short stories are so difficult, and yours are wonderful. The ones that I have read, I absolutely love. And as I mentioned in the introduction, I'll be putting a link to it in the show notes. It just made me cry in such a good way. In such a good way, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
I've read it a few times, and it makes me cry every time.
Oh, thank you for telling me that.
No, not at all. Thank you for writing it. So what? Was it an easy decision to decide, right, I'm going to do short stories, or how was your sort of thought process in terms of what am I going to write? Was that a simple decision?
Well, actually, I mean, the first things I ever published were short stories. The first mm-hmm. things, well, I suppose as a kid, I started writing short stories because that was as long as I could write. Uh-huh. But when I was a teenager, I started writing novels. I think I wrote my first one when I was 13, which would... I will never, ever try to publish in my entire life. It would be a disaster. But so I was writing novels. I don't know how many exactly I wrote. When I go on school visits, I say, well, I started writing novels when I was 13. I wrote probably about one a year for most of the years of my life until I sold my first one at 30.
It's practice.
Yes.
It's practice.
Yes.
Yes.
It was really mm-hmm. good practice.
Mm-hmm.
And short stories at first for me were only if I had a sort of creative blitz, you know, out of the mm-hmm. blue, something would grab me, you know, I'd write it. Mm. And I managed to sell 2 short stories that way to sort of small places. But they weren't something I felt comfortable writing. They weren't something I felt confident with until I went to the Clarion Workshop, where mm-hmm. what you write is short stories. It's one story a week. So it's a real boot camp for short story writing.
Uh-huh.
And the idea is that it's too hard to critique novels in a 6-week workshop. You can't write
Absolutely.
A new novel while you're there.
No.
So you write short stories and that teaches you about, you know, all sorts of parts of the craft. whether or not, you know, you actually want to write short stories ever again. And what I found out was actually I really love short stories. I was surprised by how much I love short stories once I learned how to do it, really.
Okay.
So I kept writing short stories very regularly. And I still love novels, and I sort of alternated because, you know, I'd write a novel and then I'd write a few short stories. And sometimes I take breaks from the novels just to do short stories for fun, because they're really, it's really satisfying to write a short story, because I can do that depending on the length. You know, I've written, my last short story that was published was a very, very short story. It was 1300 words. So I wrote that, you know, in 2 hours. It was an evening's work. Gosh. It was incredibly satisfying creatively. So you sit down, you write, you finish. Whereas a novel, you know, is months and months and months of effort, you know. So
I love that idea. The finish line is so far away with a novel.
Yes, it's great to have a short story give you a little burst of satisfaction.
I can see that.
I did it. And, you know, in a long short story might take me a week or two. Yeah, but again, it's still so much quicker than a novel.
Yes.
Once I started selling novels, though, and having deadlines, then I lost time for short stories. So that's been the only downside of starting to sell my novels, is I would like to write more short stories. But short stories, to be brutally practical, short stories don't make much money.
No.
You can't make a living off short stories. You can't really make a living off novels either, to be honest. But you can make more of a living. I can pay the rent for more months.
Yes.
When I write.
I hear you.
So I really love them both. I would hate to give up either of them forever. I spend a lot more of my time on novels for many obvious reasons. And novels are probably, I mean, they're my first love. They're what I, if I had to choose one and I wasn't getting paid for either of them, it would probably be the novels, but I'd hate it. I'd hate to give up the short story fun.
Absolutely. And I also wanted to say that, or ask you really about choosing genre. I mean, I know that you were, I think you're a big sort of fantasy fiction fan, weren't you?
Absolutely.
From way back. But I wondered whether it was easy for you to choose what to write, because I know that I found that was something I struggled with a lot. People would say, you know, write what you love. And I'd think, but I love everything. That does not help. And also on a personal note, I also wanted to say thank you to you, because you helped me overcome this difficulty. I was struggling to write sort of more literary fiction for my master's. And I was really, I was on a bit of a low ebb confidence wise with writing in general. I'd had an agent who hadn't been able to sell my book, and I went to do the master's to try and regain some confidence and some love of just writing. And the master's was great for many, many things, but it was very, perhaps unsurprisingly, it was very highbrow English literature. And I felt that I had to, which is entirely my insecurity, I felt like I had to please my tutors and my lecturers. So I was struggling to write
more
literary fiction.
I think that's what you're trying to do at school. Is please your lecturers.
Well, this is true. That's kind of how you do it, isn't it? And I'd always been a good student, so I was trying to be a good student. But I read an interview with you, and I'm probably misremembering it and misquoting you. But I think that you mentioned dealing with something similar about in terms of struggling with what you were writing, and then almost giving yourself permission to write the cat book, I think it was, that was for fun more. And it just, it was the right thing to read at the right time for me. So thank you so much. And it just almost made me feel that maybe it's okay if I write the fun thing that's calling to me rather than this stuff that I feel like I should be doing. And that's the book I sold. That's my first published novel. That I wrote as soon as the master's finished. I went and wrote it. And I was thinking, that's fine. Stephanie's done it. Stephanie says it's okay. So you didn't know, but you were my unofficial mentor.
Oh, that's great. And if it helps at all, I felt so much empathy as you told that story, because I also had an agent before my current agent.
Oh, really?
And didn't sell any books with the first agent.
Oh, gosh. It's a tough business, this,
isn't
it?
It's really tough.
And this is exactly why I've started this podcast, is because I've had these unofficial mentors who had no idea they were helping me, like yourself. And every time you hear that, you're not the only person to have had more than one agent, or to have not sold your first book, or to have taken whatever it is. I think that it gives the chance of being that right comment at the right time for somebody else, because I've benefited from that so much.
Oh, I'm so glad.
And so I wanted to ask you, there is a question after all of that blether. So was that something that you found?
Yes. Yes, I'd been actually that's two-parter. Harking
Okay.
back to your master's at a lesser level, as much as I loved the Clarion Workshop and I got so much out of it as a writer, I mean it was the best decision I ever made as a writer was going to that workshop. It was great. The one thing is I came out of it feeling a little nervous about trying to write anything sort of lighthearted or funny because and I don't know. I don't know even why exactly, but I think it's a little harder to critique sometimes humor at it around a table when people are going around a table. I didn't write any humor stories when I was at Clarion actually, but a couple people did, and it didn't go that well. And for some reason, I don't want to put the finger on anyone. None of our tutors ever said this. It's just for some reason I came out sort of feeling like serious writers write serious fiction. And I wanted to be a serious writer because serious writers are impressive. And
Absolutely.
I have written some quite dark fiction that was some of the happiest writing sounds like the wrong word for saying for dark. But I have really loved some of writing some of my stories, like the one you mentioned. That was incredibly, what's the right, cathartic. For me to write. I wrote that story, Dancing in the
Okay.
Dark, after having a loss in of someone that I love very much. And, writing that story helps more than almost anything else. I wrote stories after the deaths of both my grandfathers. I wrote, this is how I process as I write fiction. And I love writing that extremely emotional, sometimes dark stuff, especially with short stories. And I've been working on adult fiction for a while with my first agent. We'd come very close to selling one adult historical fantasy. And then I started writing some others, which were, it was sort of getting darker and darker, the stuff I was writing. And I thought, so it's a combination of sort of feeling like if I want to be a serious writer, I should be writing dark as dark as possible. And then I also thought, I've come so close to selling with my adult stuff. And with my more serious stuff, what I obviously need to do if I care about my career is really, put my foot down on the gas and go and keep doing it that way. So when I had my idea for the first cat book, I mean, it came so strongly. I was chopping onions in the kitchen, and I heard this girl's voice in my head saying I was 12 years of age when I chopped off my hair and dressed as a boy and set off to save my family from impending ruin. And it was amazing. I've never had inspiration like that. But I didn't let myself follow it because I thought, no, that's irresponsible and that's impractical. And I've got to stick with the serious stuff. And then I got very ill, unfortunately. I got ME, which is, it took about 2 years to get it diagnosed. And it was a horrible,
Oh
horrible
gosh.
long process. And when I finally got the diagnosis, that was actually in some ways the worst because all that time I had been waiting to get the diagnosis so that I would get medicine and get better. And instead, I got the diagnosis, and they said, "You'll never get better."
That's not a
Yes,
good
there's nothing
diagnosis, is
we
it?
can do. Just
No,
this is your life now,
no.
and that was horrible. And so, I went into a real depression for a while. I mean, I went through all the 5 stages of grief. I was sinking into a fairly dark place. This was not what I planned for my life. This is not anything. And I could not then, when I went into writing, which has always been sort of my emotional escape. Then I was writing the stuff that's quite dark and angsty, and I couldn't do it. It was just not what I needed at that point in my life. So at that point, I thought, forget it. Maybe I'll never sell a book if I change genres, but I need to do something to make myself happy. And this book makes me happy. So that's what I did. And
Oh, that's
as a matter of
wonderful.
fact, it showed how ridiculous my assumptions were because then that book sold as the first in a trilogy for a wonderful deal and it sold in 3 countries. And I feel so silly that I put off writing it for so long because I thought it was the impractical, uncommercial, whatever.
But that's what's so difficult, is because we do have to make it's the indecision of art and commerce, and we have to make business
Absolutely.
decisions in a business in which
Yes, in
nobody
which
knows
ways there's no way
anything.
to predict.
And there's no way to predict it. But I find it hugely inspirational and encouraging that the writing, what you need to be writing for yourself, can actually be the thing that you quote unquote should
Absolutely
be
right.
writing, the thing that will bring you that professional career success. And I also completely agree with you on the emotional, your emotional state of mind, because writing it, well, for me, it is
absolutely.
An escape. And if sometimes it's not what you need to be writing in a more dark way. And I also, that you said about short stories, that's interesting to me. I thought perhaps maybe to go into that very more dark place for a short story, it's quite,
absolutely.
That's quite doable. Go and visit that dark place for a short story, but I don't want to
that's
live
exactly
there for a
year.
That's exactly
how I feel. It's really cathartic to let it out in a short story. And it's really depressing to live in there for a whole novel.
Absolutely.
And the one thing I'd sort of add in from there is, I was thinking, just in relation to what we were just saying, is I think when you are writing what you emotionally need to be writing, or what really calls to you, I think you're much more likely to write with real spark, and it tends to be that extra something that makes a manuscript special. And something that I've talked a lot about with some of my other friends is one of the surprises to me and to a lot of writers I know after we sold our first book is that it's in some ways harder to sell the next book than it was the first book. You're no longer a debut author who could be the next great thing. You know, you have, there's a lot of pressure. You have to figure, you know, what's the next right book to sell is a big question for you, for your agent, for any editors who are interested. It can be a very disheartening process. And so the final conclusion that some of my friends and I have really come to is that you have to write the books that call to you, because if you write purely to try to figure out what's the next book I can sell, then if it doesn't sell, which is entirely possible, then you've had no benefit. You've just wasted a year of your life and of your writing. And whereas if you write something that you love, then if it doesn't sell, it'll still break your heart. You'll still cry, but you'll have really gotten something out of that year. And I don't regret a single novel that I've ever written. And it didn't matter that some of them were published, some of them weren't. If I loved writing it, then it really made a difference to me. And I grew as a writer by writing it.
So the title of this podcast is The Worried Writer. So this is when I'm delve into any struggles with writing. I mean, you're so productive, as I said, and I'm always watching from the sidelines and thinking, how does she do it? And you have that discipline. But do you ever suffer from any sort of creative block, or is there a part of the process that you find particularly difficult?
Oh, absolutely. And actually, this is coming back to what we were just talking about. I would say I posted about this on my blog, is that the one time I did get really sort of blocked up was over the last year. And it was a period I was going through when I got too hung up on what was the right book to write next. And I ended up drafting one book that I have to say for the first time in years was not the book that I really wanted to be writing. And I wrote it to fill, it was sort of ticking off these points. I wanted it to be very commercial. I wanted to write like some writers who I really admire who are very commercial. I didn't want to write like me because I thought, you know, I want to write a commercial book that will sell, because to be completely frank, my family, you know, needed the income. I've got a chronic illness. If I don't sell books, then that's a real issue for my family. Yeah,
it's your job. And so those practical considerations are there,
absolutely.
Whether we like it, you know,
yeah,
whether we like it or
since
not.
Yeah, especially having kids. You know, when you look at your kids and you think, you know, we need to pay rent, we need to buy new clothes, we need to do these things, I need to sell a book. So
it's a terrible pressure, isn't it?
And I got to a state, so I thought, fine, I'm going to write a book that is guaranteed to sell. Ha ha. So, I was writing it trying to match a different writer's style. I was writing it in a setting that was contemporary, which I enjoy writing contemporary short stories. So far, I have never wanted to write a contemporary novel. I like historical settings, but historical settings are, according to some people, it's a difficult market to sell. So I was going to write a contemporary setting, and I was, you know, it was just, it was a, it was a little tick list of what would be commercial. And I wrote it. And you know, really, I put my craft into it and I did my best. And I heard back from my agent. And honestly, the book hadn't worked. It needed a total rethink. And then I spent about 10 months struggling because I was trying to figure out how to rewrite it. And the way to rewrite it to sort of be truthful to the book as I had drafted it, I was to rewrite it all from the point of view of one character who's the most dramatic character who I just didn't happen to like. I mean, she was not the kind of heroine I want to write. And it was becoming more and more earnest, a book with no sort of humor or quirkiness. And I forced myself through about 12,000 words, and it was a total sludge. It felt like paint by numbers. Mm-hmm. I sent it back to my agent. He said, you know, this isn't working either. I think we need to start again. And I thought, I can't do this. I can't do this anymore. And it's stupid. It's like I said before, when you write a book you love, maybe it'll sell, maybe it won't. But it's worth it. And this one, I'm writing a book I don't love and I hate writing it. And I don't think it's going to sell because to be honest, I've never managed to sell any short story or a novel that I didn't love writing. And I think when I don't love writing, when I'm forcing myself through it, people can tell. So that was my big block. Uh-huh. And it was quite traumatic at the time. But
it's hard to say goodbye to a lot of work.
It is. And a lot of time. And also a lot of time I could have spent writing something I liked.
don't think about it.
But what happened actually was, well, it was twofold. It was, I pulled out a manuscript that I loved that I thought, oh, this is too quirky. You know, there's no point showing my agent all these things. I showed it to him and he sold it.
Stephanie.
That's my next book. And I started writing. I wrote down the openings for two other books, and I finished the first draft of one of them last month. I'm revising it now. And that one, I just wrote purely for love. I thought this is really quirky and it's, and I really love it. And I'm just going to write it. I don't care. I really right now, I need to write for myself. I need to write the book I love and this is it. So I did that and I wrote another opening for another book, which I'll be working on next. And it was really what's the right word? Well, it's a clarion call for me. It was saying I've gone off the path and I need to get back on and write the books that are actually personal to me and that work for me, not try to write the books that would work for someone who isn't me.
Yes. Yes. I think that's brilliant advice. Hard won. Brilliant advice.
Yes.
In terms of process, do you find, are any of the processes more likely to get you stuck or more likely for you to be procrastinating?
I enjoy first drafts more than anything else. First drafts are just fun. I don't outline ahead of time. I find the story out as I write. I sort of write along and my guiding motto is, what's the worst thing that could happen next? And I do that and then see what happens. And it's really fun. It's a really fun process. And I get through, and so I'm sort of telling myself the story as I write it. I'm working out by the end of this draft. I know what the story was, and then I have to go back and fill it all in and make it all coherent and make the beginning fit the ending, which is always a bit of an issue for me because I am sort of writing my way into the story and into the style and everything. I can't count how many times I rewrote the beginning to each of the cat books. But so the first draft is the fun draft. And then I have to be, not that I don't have to be disciplined to get the first draft done, because there's all the usual things. I'm tired. I don't feel like it, whatever. But in general, I enjoy first drafts. I don't enjoy editing and revising, but it's a job. And that's where the discipline comes in. And so what I tend to do there, I go through, I reread the book on my own. I fix all the problems that are so obvious that even I can see them and I know how to fix them. Then I send them out to other writers I know. And get them to read and critique it. I do another rewrite. I send it to my agent. And then he has his critique. And then I do more rewrites. And it takes a lot of discipline and a lot of chocolate.
Yes. Yes. Again, we are writing twins. I don't outline. And I discover what the book is in the first couple of very, very messy drafts. Which are quite bare bones, and then I go back and make it into an actual story, which makes some sense.
Yes, there was one time When my agent asked to see the very first draft before I'd gone through and even polished it myself, and I said, "It's really rough. I don't think you understand how rough it'll be." I really cringed. He said, "No, I really, and I sent it. I'm never doing that again." He was very nice about it,
No,
but I couldn't take
no.
it. And I don't want anyone to see it at that stage.
No, I completely
Although I
appreciate
should say the
that.
only exception I have with that rule is something that I use to get myself through the writing that actually is I found is a really important part of my process is to keep my confidence up, especially if I'm feeling insecure, is I use a system of beta readers where I trade with a couple of writer friends and we send each other chapters as we write, and there's a very strict rule, which is you can't do any critique whatsoever. You read the chapter and you respond with at least one thing that was good about it. And you can always find something. I mean, worst case comes to worst, you say, "What, what wonderful spelling," which is thank God never happened. But so we're cheering each other on. And that really helps in
Okay.
terms of what we were talking about before. Novels are a very long process. The end goal is so far away. It really helps to get little
Oh.
bursts of positivity and encouragement to help you keep going. And you have to do it with someone you really trust. And you have to do it with someone who really understands that process, who isn't, I have done it before with writers I really like and admire, and but who don't really share that process. So they'll say, "Oh, but I'm sure you'd like to know that I think the plot is going a little off track." And I do not want to know that. I really don't. This is my first draft. That can really screw me up if I find out at that point. I need to get a full draft done before I realize all the problems and I can fix them at that point. If I get hung up on problems partway through a draft, I might abandon the book. It just doesn't work for me. I need to sort of blow through the first draft
No.
and cheer confidence. So it's a matter of finding the right people to trade with and get cheering on and encouragement. And every chapter, I finish it and I think, "Ooh, there's an accomplishment." I send it off. My beta readers reply, different ones for each book usually, and say, "Ooh, I really like this about it," or, "I really like that about it." And I get this little glow. And then I read that email before I write the next chapter. And it's a little small thing, but it really helps with keeping confidence and keeping faith.
That's an excellent tip. And so I was going to ask if things have changed for you over time, or would you have any advice for people who are at the pre-publication stage? And so leading on from that, would it be a case of making friends with other
Oh,
people who like to
yes.
write and form?
Absolutely. That
Okay.
was so crucial for me. For me, it happened mostly through going to that residential workshop and then having the listserv afterwards. It also happened through LiveJournal, making friends on there with other writers.
Okay.
One of my, actually, multi several of my best friends now are actually other writers I met through reading their blogs and commenting on their blogs. And it's wonderful to
Oh,
get
that's
community,
wonderful.
especially if you don't know other writers in your normal life. And by the time that I started making friends with other writers through blogs, I was living with another writer, so I wasn't as desperate as I had been in other times. But it makes a huge difference to feel like you're part of a community and to feel like what you're doing is worthwhile, whether or not it's ever going to be published. That you're actually all part of this community of people doing this very cool, challenging endeavor together, and it's worth it whether or not it ever ends up on a bookshelf. And then also, of course, it's really useful to know other writers who can critique your work because it makes it a lot more likely that you will get published later.
Yes, definitely, definitely. And getting that small wins
Yes.
within a long project is also an
It really
excellent
makes a
tip.
difference. It really, it, without it, I think there'd be a lot of times when I did get depressed and insecure and just think, I just can't make myself do it right now because what if it's all, what if it's all a waste?" Which is a silly thing, but it can get thrown
Yes.
up by my subconscious when I'm feeling very insecure and very tired and et cetera. And getting those little, I know one writer who calls them pellets, like rats in an experiment getting pellets, if you're doing the right thing. Getting those little pellets of encouragement, it can make all the difference with keeping you moving.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's brilliant. Well, I don't want to keep you much longer because I know I'm in your writing time right now. I could talk to you all day, but I just want to finish up by asking you what you're working on at the moment or what's coming next
Sure.
for
Yeah,
readers.
my next book is coming out next spring, 2016. It's called Masks and Shadows, and it was so much fun. It was going back to I started out in music, and this is all of my obsessions. It's set in the Palace of Esterháza in Hungary in 1779 when Haydn was the court composer there, and it it's all sort of based around the opera house, and it's a very operatic book. It's divided into acts like an opera. It's very wildly romantic, you know, sort of over the top. And there is, it's told from several points of view from people who lived around this isolated palace. I mean, because Esterházy, it wasn't just a building, you know, it was a whole community. It was this very self-sufficient domain ruled by the prince. And so you've got the perspectives of a soldier, of a maid, of a singer in the opera house, etc. So one of the taglines we're using is 18th century Downton Abbey with magic.
Wow. I love that.
It was really, really fun to write. But but out of all those voices, the main sort of heart of the story is a romantic storyline going along with the magical storyline. And the romance is between a castrato opera singer and a very, very proper widowed aristocratic woman who should not be getting involved with a castrato opera singer. But of course, they end up getting involved and falling in love while trying to deal with this really dangerous alchemical magic. And, you know, that's all wrapped up in a plot to assassinate the emperor and empress. And it's over the top, romantic, and enormously fun for me, at least.
That sounds wonderful. And I'm actually sitting on my hands to stop myself from giving it the idea a round of applause. It just sounds right up my street. I cannot wait to read that. So that's out 2016. And I love the title, Masks and Shadows.
We'll see if it stays. I hope it stays.
I also wondered, well, I like that. It'll always be Masks and Shadows to me. At least one person, that'll be it. I also wanted to put in links into the show notes so that people can obviously find your books and find out more about you. So where would be the central place that people should head
my
to
website.
Straight away?
It's www.stephanieburgess.com. And not only are there links to all the books, and so on, there's excerpts of each of the three cat books and also the novella that I wrote after the cat books, which was Kat a few years on having a romance of her own.
And that's called Courting Magic. And I just reread it this week because I knew I was going to be speaking to you. And yes, again, that's just wonderful and so much fun. And the sort of comic, it's a very gently comic voice that you have, but also the detail, the period detail and the sort of sumptuous fun.
Oh, that's just
of
what
it
I
all.
Wanted. Thank you.
I highly, highly recommend it. And I do love a romance as well. So I love that Kat gets this romance. I won't say any more. I won't say any more. So yes, do check that out. I will put a link to that in the show notes. So it just remains for me to say thank you so much for your time, Stephanie. I really, really appreciate you being here to talk to me.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I really enjoyed it.
Okay, thanks a lot. Bye, Stephanie. Thanks for listening today. For show notes and links, head to worriedwriter.com. If you'd like to connect, find me on Twitter at Sarah R. Painter or use the hashtag worriedwriter. See you next time.